From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Springfield is broken. The politicians' answer to every problem is higher taxes and more spending. It's a symptom of the larger issues in Springfield: greed, corruption, and the belief among politicians that it's more important to reward their special interest allies than to look out for Illinois families. I'm Tom Demmer, and that's why I'm running for treasurer.
I don't want to get into specifics yet because I don't want to get locked into anything in particular, but we have to step up and address those issues that are affecting everyday people. People shouldn't worry about carjackings and retail theft.
We have never had this many COVID patients in the hospital at any point in the pandemic, not in spring of 2020, not in the winter of 2020.
Well, COVID continues to surge in Illinois and across the country, and some are predicting light at the end of the tunnel, but hospitals, they're struggling to keep up right now. Also, we heard from Chris Welch in there. He's been in the speaker's office for more than a year now, and he talked with reporters this week. We'll discuss some of what he had to say, and also we'll figure out more of what's going on the Republican side of the ballot for this upcoming election. Republican Representative Tom Demmer says he's running for state treasurer. Looks like he'll be part of a slate of Republican candidates. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Emeritus Professor and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's been a longtime State House reporter and observer. Hannah Meisel's with us. She is our NPR Illinois State House editor. And joining us today, Mike Miletich. He covers state government for Gray TV. Mike, it's good to have you back with us.
Thanks, Sean. Always glad to be on.
Well, let's start with politics. As I mentioned there, looks like there's going to be a slate of candidates on the Republican side of the ticket, including another candidate for governor. Aurora's Mayor Richard Irvin is believed to be close to announcing that he will join the race. Hannah, what is going on the Republican side?
Well, as has been rumored for a while, a slate of, fairly moderate business-focused Republicans are going to be running for the top of the ticket. And these are folks who are, being backed by, kind of the same team that brought you Rauner 2014, Mark Kirk 2010. These are very talented, Republican operatives who understand what it means to be a Republican in Illinois. And, they're trying their best to, of course, distance themselves, their candidates, from the national quagmire that is the GOP these days. But it's a really interesting idea. And of course, Ken Griffin, one of the richest people in Illinois, who of course is a mega conservative mega donor that we've talked about a lot on this program. He is said to be behind this operation, of course, but he's denying it, and there is, some plausible deniability there with, how things are funded, but, obviously he's going to get involved. But it's been super interesting to, finally watch this ticket shape up, and we saw three announcements this week. At the top of the show there, we heard Tom Demmer, who is a current state rep. He's been in office for about, 8 years now. He was elected in 2012. He has kind of risen to the top in the House budgeting process. He's running for treasurer. And then we also saw announcements for comptroller and attorney general. This follows an announcement last week for Secretary of State by John Millhiser, the former U.S. attorney for the Central District of Illinois. These folks are all running, kind of together. I haven't asked yet if they have a secret handshake. But yes, on Monday, it's confirmed to several news outlets that Richard Irvin, the mayor of Aurora, will announce along with Avery Bourne, another, young rising star representative in the House. It'll be a very, very interesting ticket. You've got a lot of diversity. You've got a lot of, young energy. And again, these are folks who can, plausibly say that they're not part of this national GOP shift. You know, these are folks who are, you know, they've been in Republican politics for a long time, but they are solidly Illinois Republicans, meaning, you know, moderate Republicans, business focused Republicans. But it does seem like we are going to relive the last few election cycles over and over again, when we have, you know, one side using Bruce Rauner as the boogeyman and the other side using Mike Madigan as the boogeyman, despite the fact that both of them are out of power.
Yeah, Charlie, your thoughts on what this could shape up to be, maybe the ticket for Republicans, as and there's still a ways to go there, but going into the fall this year.
Yeah, it could be. And to pick up on what Hannah mentioned, I think it's going to be just, what would you say, a pretty low down, dirty campaign, a lot of mud swinging. It's going to be, here are Griffin's puppets, his hand chosen pick of people who are going to be his zombies, as opposed to, well, here are the clones of Mike Madigan. And I think the average voter is going to say a pox on all your houses. Let's talk about issues that are important to myself. For example, the woman who is apparently part of this moderate slate is McHenry County Auditor Shannon Teresi. And when she announced her candidacy on her campaign website, and this is according to a story by Taylor Avery of the Sun-Times, the first issue listed on her website was a pledge to end the Madigan machine's personal piggy bank. And on her web page, she mentions Madigan three times. She doesn't even mention Mendoza once. She says she's got an eagle eye to root out the waste, fraud, and abuse our state is plagued by thanks to decades of Madigan machine politics. Now, Madigan has been out of public life for a year and a couple of days. And I wonder if voters are going to not get tired of it. And so the Democrats fired back and said, now Ken Griffin is running the Rauner reboot, revealing his slate of puppets in a desperate bid to pull Illinois back to the Rauner days of budget impasses and month-long bill backlogs. And as a matter of fact, Mendoza can point to the fact that the backlog, which was $16.7 billion 4 years ago, is now down as of Friday morning, as we're taping the show, is $3.9 billion. Our credit rating has been improved for the first time in 20 years. Bills are being paid on average, like in a month, which is normal procedure. So it's going to be, and I use the comptroller's race just as an example, it's going to be the incumbent saying, well, here are the things that I achieved in office. And it's going to be the challengers saying, yeah, but you're part of the Madigan machine. It'll be interesting to see. And of course, we should also note that there's no guarantee that Griffin's favored candidates are going to emerge from the primary. You mentioned that John Millhiser is running for Secretary of State. Dan Brady, a state representative from Bloomington, declared, oh gosh, months ago that he wanted to be Secretary of State. So there's going to be a primary challenge there. And of course, at the top, you've got, I guess, Darren Bailey would be the leading, what would you say, challenger, or the most outspoken, the guy who's gotten the most ink. He's a state senator from Xenia. And so there's no guarantee that Richard Irvin would be automatically the GOP nominee for governor.
Yeah, and that's a good point, Charlie. That's something I want to get into. Mike, you cover a lot of the downstate territory in Illinois, and that's where people like Darren Bailey seem to be the strongest. I've talked to several Republicans who would probably look at this slate of candidates and say to themselves, these are the people that we're rebelling against in our own party. We're tired of that career politician style. So basically, this is not necessarily, like Charlie said, this is not a slam dunk that this slate can win.
That's a really good point, Sean. A lot of people that have joined onto that Bailey train, I like to call it, are against the funded candidates. You know, there's several people that have been on social media saying, we don't need all this money from Ken Griffin in order to win an election. Now, will that be true or not? Obviously, we'll have to see there, because money makes a big difference. And we all know that when it comes down to candidates that can move forward. It does seem, though, that when you have so many people from different backgrounds that have stronger ideas than some of the candidates that are currently out there, it could lead people to start to second think what their choices are right now for the candidates that they support. I do think, though, that this slate will play well for suburban Republicans and Republicans that are in the Chicago area as compared to downstate. But we'll have to see. I mean, that it's an interesting choice to have Avery Bourne in as the lieutenant governor candidate, because there you do have someone that is very well liked downstate, specifically in her district. And that could mean a lot to help out Richard Urban.
But let me make one final point. For people like Representative Avery Bourne, Representative Tom Demmer, this is a, what would you say? In a sense, it's a do or die effort, because every legislative seat is going to be up in November. So they don't have the luxury of running for a statewide office, and if they lose their statewide bid, being able to kind of glide back into their legislative seat. They will be out of the legislature come, you know, whether they win or lose, they will not be lawmakers when the next General Assembly is sworn in a year from now.
That's a good point. Let me move on. It was touched on earlier, and Mike, it's hard to believe it's been a year since Michael Madigan was the Speaker of the Illinois House. That means that Chris Welch has now been in that role for a little bit more than a year, and he spoke to reporters this week. What did you take away from that?
You know, you're right. Most people that are outside of our realm of state politics probably don't realize that Speaker Madigan is no longer in power. But a lot changed over the past year. And you look at just all the bills that were able to move last year, and let alone the management of the House as well. Speaker Welch brought up that he was able to have a lot more accessibility. You see diversity within his leadership team as well, which was a huge element. And a big thing that was moved forward, well, yes, there were many Democratic ideals that were pushed forward, like clean energy, voting rights, of course, things that are contrasting some of the other proposals that moved across the country, you know, trying to make sure that a woman's reproductive health was protected, was all done. But he also said something that is rare when you're talking about the Illinois House, listening to people on both sides of the aisle. While yes, we hear a lot of the same talking points from Republicans to this day about, you know, is it really a new day in Springfield? Our bills aren't being passed. You know, they are being listened to by the Speaker, which is something new. It's interesting to see what will happen now. Obviously, the second year of a General Assembly is a little bit more laid back as compared to the first year. But there still seems to be that sense of urgency to address COVID-19 issues and also look at the rising crime. And that's a big thing, because a lot of people looked at the Legislative Black Caucus effort for criminal justice reform as a huge win for Democrats. But Republicans have been against many of the changes within that for a while. The interesting part, though, is that they're attacking the elimination of cash bail that was part of that, but that doesn't even take effect until 2023. So a lot of the talking points that are in there just don't make sense with what happened at this point. But criminal justice will definitely be discussed this year as well.
Yeah, Hannah, he spoke about that. I know didn't give a lot of detail, but he did bring up carjackings, a lot of these retail thefts we've heard about, the organized retail thefts. So, you know, do we have any idea what could be on the table?
No, he was very tight-lipped, and he, you know, we heard at the top there, he didn't want to necessarily go into specifics to not be tied down. But I also don't know that, you know, he has a hard and fast idea already. You know, Mike did allude to the fact that he, you know, more so than Speaker Madigan, obviously, he's more willing to take suggestions. on that. But it is interesting because, you know, he has to toe this very fine line between defending the criminal justice package that was passed, you know, a year ago this week, but and also, you know, tweaked, gosh, at least twice now. And, you know, defend that. Obviously, as Mike said, there are things that haven't taken effect yet, but to the public, and I think, you know, even to the law enforcement community, you know, one thing that you hear a lot out of that law enforcement community is like people are leaving the field because they feel unsupported. And, you know, unfortunately, feelings sometimes trump facts. And, you know, if they feel unsupported, despite what is specifically in that criminal justice package, you know, doesn't really matter when they're leaving the force at the end of the day. Anyway, and so, yeah, he has to toe the line between defending that and then, you know, trying to come up with a targeted approach to stop the proliferation of, you know, for example, carjackings and, you know, organized retail theft, which, you know, both of those things are a problem nationwide, even more so during the pandemic, because it's created incentives, for example, on the retail theft. You know, you have this huge uptick in people shopping online. And so criminals say, oh, well, that's, you know, that gives me an incentive to go do these smash and grab thefts and then resell things online. So you've created for yourself a whole new market. And it's really hard for, you know, one state government to address that when it might be a, you know, something that the FBI should be more involved in. And, you know, I'm sure that they are, but, you know, we haven't seen a whole sale stoppage to it. Anyway, it's going to be really interesting. But yeah, he was not specific. And I think that's because he doesn't have a plan yet on, as we tape this on January 14th.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Mike Miletich with Gray TV. Well, DCFS, this agency is always under the spotlight, and yet here we are again watching it make some headlines, unfortunately, with a caseworker who in Sangamon County was killed while making a call on a child welfare check, and that was a couple of weeks back. And also, there have been some questions about the director and how the agency is being run right now. Mike, fill us in on what's going on with DCFS.
Well, Sean, you have multiple issues right there that are adding up, specifically for Director Mark Smith. He was facing three separate cases with children who were not placed properly, that were left in psychiatric hospitals. While there are so many, I mean, over 350 youth in care that have been in situations like that, he was held in contempt of court for violating the rights of those three children. The third was just announced yesterday. And it's just questioning of what has been done during Director Smith's time in that role. I mean, he's been there nearly 3 years. And while there are small reforms that happen every few years, we see proposals that are passed that people say, okay, we're finally improving the child welfare system. People are really looking at the situation right now, specifically for the well-being of children, and also, as you said, the DCFS investigators and caseworkers. How can we truly improve the system and look into ways to better reform the agency? So some of the proposals people are saying, you know, let's have more transparency in where children are being kept and what is actually happening on a daily basis, and also looking at having more DCFS employees, because clearly, as there is everywhere, there's been a great resignation. But when you don't have the true amount of employees that you need, you fall into situations like this where people are overworked and they may end up in a situation where they go to a house and they may be alone and get into a tragic situation without prior warning. The only other thing that they're seeing right now is several lawmakers want to have hearings to ask the director about these situations and have him on the record to say what solutions there could be.
Charlie, let's put this into some context. I mean, anybody that's been around state government for a while has heard the phrase, this is the most difficult job in state government, being in charge of DCFS. I would say that still applies, but your thoughts on how things are going right now?
Well, this is kind of a, what would you say? It's a recurring situation, and it's tragic, and we've still not been able to figure out how to do, you know, how to deal with it. The notion was to close these residential beds to put, I guess what you call them, troubled children, children in need of psychiatric care, put them in better placements. Well, we've closed something like 500 beds in the last, what, half a dozen years, but they never were able to find foster homes providing specialized services. And so that was the instances in the three contempt orders issued against Director Mark Smith this past week. And the first two of them were expunged after the agency was able to find a placement for a couple of the kids. There was another one entered, I think it was on Thursday, involving a 17-year-old boy who's been in a psychiatric hospital since last September because the agency couldn't find a placement for him. So that contempt order is still in. And one of the things that I thought was interesting is the judge who issued these contempt orders, and this is the first time the director has ever been held in contempt, is a guy named Patrick Murphy. Patrick Murphy, years ago, was the guardian in Cook County. So he knows this stuff inside out because he was the one advocating for children in DCFS care several decades ago. And the ACLU has been on this case too. They first filed a lawsuit against DCFS in 1988. And the agency has just really been troubled. And, you know, the Republicans in the legislature say, we need another hearing to get into this and figure this stuff out. It occurs to me a couple of things that need to be done. First, you need to hire more people. You should not be sending caseworkers out into these troubled situations by themselves. They should have backup. They should have some kind of a device that would allow them to summon help immediately, some kind of a panic button if they're in a difficult situation. You should reduce the caseload for caseworkers so they can do a better job on that. And you should figure out some way to take kids who need psychiatric care, not just lock them up until they're deemed ready to be released, but you have nowhere to put them. And it's going to take a concerted effort. It's going to take more money, unfortunately. There's a story the other day that in the last 10 years, more than 1,100 children who had contact with DCFS have died. And that's just reprehensible.
I want to save a couple of minutes here just because we need to mention COVID and where things stand across the state with the coronavirus at this point. We've been seeing hospitals filling up, case numbers going way up as well. Hannah, earlier this week, I believe the Department of Public Health, we heard there had a news conference. Did we gain any insight as to where things stand with this whole pandemic right now?
Well, you know, I don't want to say anything hard and fast because things could also always change. And as we've said throughout this entire pandemic, there are things that are lagging indicators of new cases, like hospitalizations usually take about a couple of weeks. And then if someone were to die, that usually would take place about the 3-week mark after someone was diagnosed. But we might be at some sort of plateau. Maybe, I want to heavily couch that, but that doesn't mean that, you know, life is automatically better. The pandemic's over, unfortunately. You know, hospitals are still struggling with staffing, you know, and as we've talked about in the show, it's not just that people are leaving the field, but it's that healthcare workers are themselves becoming infected with COVID and then they can't return to work. Although we've seen some anecdotal evidence from all over the country that people, you know, some places are so short-staffed that people are, healthcare workers are being asked to show up to work anyway, even if they are COVID positive. It is not a great situation. The state has deployed a little over 2,000 healthcare workers from this existing staffing contract that we've had for, you know, most of the last 2 years to especially short-staffed hospitals. But, you know, We've seen, you know, again, it's not perfectly analogous, especially because it's summer in South Africa, and for a lot of other reasons, you know, social reasons especially. But when we saw this Omicron variant spread across South Africa, where it was first discovered, it took about 4 weeks for them to peak, and then it took about another 4 weeks to kind of get on the other side, but they're still not down to the case levels that they were seeing before Omicron, you know, came along.
It's time now for our notes from the field, and Mike, let's go to you first.
Absolutely, Sean. We had a major announcement from the Illinois Attorney General yesterday, and several other states actually, for a nationwide announcement for a student loan settlement. If you were a customer client of Navient or formerly Sallie Mae, there's a lot of money that's coming back. 18,500 Illinois student loan borrowers are going to receive a combination of nearly $5 million in restitution payments because there was a higher price for the amount that they were paying in for their loans in the interest each year. So definitely a lot of money coming to the state, and people should be excited about that.
Okay, Hannah.
Well, this week, Chicago Alderperson Pat Dowell dropped out of the crowded Secretary of State race, endorsed Alexi Janulius, which was interesting because at the state fair, she said a lot of interesting kind of underhanded things about Alexi Janulius, but I guess water under the bridge. And she joined the even more crowded race for the first congressional district, which is going to be empty because, as we discussed on the show last week, longtime Congressman Bobby Rush is not going to run again. And that is an interesting race. We have seen even more announcements this week, notably State Senator Jackie Collins threw her hat in the ring, but Bobby Rush is expected to make an endorsement relatively soon.
And Charlie.
Well, when voters go to the polls in November and they look and they'll see the candidates for Secretary of State, and they'll see a Republican, we're not sure who. They'll see a Democrat, we're not sure who. And they'll see Jesse White, and they'll scratch their head and they'll say, oh, well, yeah, Jesse White. Well, he's been Secretary of State like forever, and he's done a good job. I'm going to vote for him. But guess what? It's not that Jesse White. Instead, the Libertarian Party of Illinois has slated Jesse White, a different Jesse White, a guy from downstate, to run as Secretary of State. And when reporters asked the Libertarians, why are you putting forward a candidate with the same name as the current very popular Secretary of State, the chair of the party, Steve Saw, said it was, oh, total coincidence. Well, who knows? Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But this is an alert for everybody out there. When you see Jesse White on the ballot in November, it's not the Jesse White.
It's a different one. All right, that's all of our time for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Gray TV's Mike Miletich. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org through the NPR One app or iTunes. Just look for State Week. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.